on the 7th, SpaceX launched another rocket to geosynchronous orbit. They launched another satellite, this time for Indonesia. Everything went well. They launched it from Launch Complex 40 in Florida. And the interesting thing about this flight, though, is because they've used the new version, the new latest iteration for the Falcon 9 booster, which takes off and lands. That's their newest version. It took off, this particular booster took off in May and launched a geosynchronous satellite to Bangladesh from the same launch complex. Here a couple of months later, they put it back on the launch complex 40 and lit it off again, and it successfully went up. Did its job. The booster itself came back 400 miles out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and again landed on the autonomous ship that they tow out to that location with a couple of boats that pull it out. They have a couple of tugs that pull these things out. Successfully landed right dead center again, bullseye. So he's gotten real good at this. This was at least 15 of them that he's done. And that is the newest version. This will be the version of the Falcon 9 that sends people to orbit to the International Space Station. It's an upgraded version. It's got landing legs. The old landing legs, they used to take off and throw them away. And they have to build new landing legs. These things are retractable. It's got a better interstage. You can tell it's different. It's black. The old one was white. The interstage, you know, is the section that connects the booster to the second stage. That's all upgraded, and the whole thing is, the whole outside is painted with some kind of heat-resistant substance, so that when it comes back, they don't look all burnt up like the original ones did. You know, like they went through a fire. They come back in good shape. And all the old ones, the Block 4, they call them, would launch, and they would reuse them, but only one time. This thing is designed to be reused up to 10 times, and then they're going to refurbish it, and then use it 10 more times, up to 100 times. To give you an idea, they plan on building about 50 of these Block 5 versions over the years. In case they lose one, you know, one gets crashes into the sea or something, they'll have plenty of backups. And that's bringing the cost of this type of thing, type of launches, way down. They plan on using the exact same booster that just went up on August 7th that took the Indonesian satellite to geosynchronous orbit in a couple more months before the end of the year. So it'll be the first time they use the same booster three times, and then over and over again after that. So I believe this is around their fourth launch. They have a launch coming up in September I'm paying attention to from California, Vandenberg Air Force Base. And that'll be an Iridium launch where they launch 10 satellites, each one weighing about 2,000 pounds. They have done this many, many times over the last couple of years. But this is an interesting flight because I know I mentioned this last week. It's going to take off from Vandenberg Air Force Base. It's going to go out. It's going to put the satellites into polar orbit. The booster is going to, you know, turn around in space 180 degrees, do a boost back burn, slowing down, you know, from its 3,500 mile hour forward speed and all the way back in the direction of Vandenberg Air Force Base. And then it's going to do an entry burn. That's where they launch, light off three more of the Falcon 9 engines as it's coming through the atmosphere. And then a final burn with the center engine of the Falcon 9 as it lands 1,400 feet away from where it took off in California. So that'll be pretty interesting. When they come back to land in Florida, they've done that many times as well, but it's always around 2.5 miles away from the from where they took off. And it's a different view in California. Everything looks totally different when they take off and when they land compared to Florida. Any comments or questions before we try AC2GS again? Let me open it to the net.
Yeah, no, Roy, let me... In the case of Falcon 9, if I don't have it all mixed up, I think you've got three boosters slapped together. And when they're going to come back to Vandenberg, you're going to be decelerating and making a landing with the center booster, and the other two are just sitting there. Is this the first time they've ever did a landing with three boosters, or do I have that mixed up? Over to you, Roy. Paul.
Okay, yeah. Go back to the basis of SpaceX. Their rocket is called the Falcon 9. Essentially, I always said they should have called it the Falcon 10 because it has 10 Merlin engines on the thing. So it's got 9 for the booster, and then the second stage separates, and then it has one Merlin engine as well. They call it a Merlin vacuum engine. So these 9 engines, for years now, have been launched from either California or from Florida. And when they come back, they either land on the autonomous drone ship out at sea, and they give the autonomous drone ship a name. You know, one's called, of course, I Just Love You, and the other one is I Just Can't. Just keep reading the directions. So it's got big long names for these big ships that are as big as a football field. So when they come down, what's confusing is they. Launch with 9 engines, and then when this one booster comes down, we drop it. If they're coming back to land, they do a boost back burn with 3 engines. If they're going out to sea, they don't need to do a boost back land. They just do a parabolic dive into the toward the ocean. And in either case, when they come through the atmosphere, they call it the reentry burn. They light off 3 more of the engines, not all 9 engines, but just 3 engines of these Merlin engines. And then as they get very close to the deck of the ship or to the land, it's only the center engine that comes on. And that's it. And then that one brings them right down to the landing. So what you're thinking of now is when they, back in February, when they launched the Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy is 3 boosters, so it's 9 engines each, 27 boosters. Let me drop it. And that's the one that he first launched in February. That launched out of Launch Complex 39A in Florida, and that went out to that was the one he sent to Mars. He put the car on board and all. But the boosters, 2 of them turned around, did a boost back burn, head back toward land with their 3 engines, 3 of the 9, and then they lit them off again, 3 more engines. As they came through the reentry, straight down toward the ground, and then at the last second, the final engines came on, and they both successfully landed right on their landing pads. It used to be Launch Complex 13, now they call it Landing Zone 1 in Florida, and that was the dramatic scene that made it to the news. People just love that. That was really impressive. So that's the deal on that. So that's the story on the Falcon 9, Dick. Back to you.
I just briefly looked at the launch of the Parker. And in the later stage of the launch, you see the 2 side boosters separating. Did any portion of that Parker spacecraft come back as a graceful landing, or was all of that spacecraft booster sacrificed? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, they're all called. NASA gives them a name. Evolved Expendable Launch Vehicles, EELV. So, yeah, they all go into the drink. That'll probably hit the ocean, maybe 400 or 500 miles out to sea. And that'll be the end of those 2 boosters. And that's why they use the RS-68A engines on those. They're liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines. They're really very similar, almost the same as the engines on the space shuttle, the RS-25. So those three engines that the space shuttle had that always came back to, they were reusable. These are not reusable, so it's a little different setup. They have an ablative inside. That's why when they launch, it's a terrific yellow flame that surrounds the whole thing. That's the ablativeness of the cone coming, you know, being blown off. The space shuttle won't have that. Let me drop it. It's a dramatic difference. Even so, they're both liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And, what you see when they got up, I think it was after 3.5 minutes, the two boosters, the port and the stop and booster separated, and you could just see the little light. It looks like a little light. And then the center one kept on going. So that's what you saw there.
When it comes to Parker, I am guessing you needed every bit of boost you could get to speed up that spacecraft as fast as it was required. Therefore, there was no boost capability left over where you stood the chance of doing a reverse burn and come back to land gracefully. That's a guess on my part. Am I even close to Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Okay, now we're talking about Parker, or we're talking about Falcon, the Falcon 9. Parker is being launched by the Delta IV, by NASA, actually by the United Launch Alliance, which is Boeing and Lockheed. They're the ones that launch all these big rockets for NASA. And then the Falcon 9 is SpaceX. That's a different world. SpaceX is all recoverable. That's their goal, is to recover everything. And NASA doesn't have that plan. Actually, they do have a plan for a future rocket called the Vulcan, which is going to eventually replace the Atlas V, which is like a real workhorse for NASA. But eventually it will be replaced by the Vulcan rocket. And there is plans on recovering just the engine sections of those particular rockets. Back to you, Dick.
So I'm guessing Parker was planned a long time ago. Had one of the Falcon boosters, if a decision very early in the game had been made to launch Parker by way of Falcon boosters, was there the possibility of getting enough boost and still be able to return the boosters to a graceful landing of Paul, K2IW?
Yeah, they would have been able to do that, but they lose like 25% or so of their efficiency when they bring their boosters back. So I'm sure NASA would have said, you know what, make these expendable boosters, just lose them, you know. And right now the cost would have been, from what I read, would have been around the same. I think it's around $300 million for a Falcon 9 Heavy, and it was about the same for the Delta IV Heavy. So I think cost-wise, it wouldn't have made a difference. You know, so they make these choices early on. I think, right now, of course, SpaceX would definitely want to get a contract like that. They've launched plenty of stuff for NASA. They're constantly launching cargo missions. They've launched the Discover mission to the L1 launch point. They launched TESS just recently, which is doing very good. So they're doing a lot of launches for NASA and for the military.
Another crazy question. In the case of Parker, which will eventually end up going around the sun in a highly elliptical orbit, and the aperture kick motor is going to be fired in a retro direction to slow down that elliptical orbit. Now, depending on when you fire the aperture kick motor, you could lower the point of apogee or lower the point of perigee. Aperhelion. You can lower the aperhelion or lower the apogee perihelion. They're going to fire the aperture kick motor to lower which one? The high point or the low point of that elliptical orbit pole? WS2N, K2RIW?
I think it's only around 7,000 or 8,000 pounds of thrust. I'll have to look it up. There's a whole bunch of, they call them Star 48, and there's a Star 37. This one's a Star 48. That means it's got a 48-inch diameter body to this solid booster rocket. So I think they're using it for accuracy to, you know, when they get, you know, getting near Venus, especially on that first pass. But I haven't, you know, I'll have to look further into that. I would not think of this as changing the apogee or perigee that much. They're going to use Venus, the seven passes of Venus over, you know, every year to do that. So we'll have to look into, you know, that final adjustment. I think they're using the Star 48 solid kick motor for that. It's not going to affect the apogee or perigee, I don't think, that much. The idea is to get near Venus.
So I'm guessing they're using Venus to dissipate some of the energy. If you just dive straight toward the sun with Parker, I think you'd have too much velocity. So Venus is being used to dissipate some of that velocity, I am guessing. And so if it's going to take seven passes of Venus and roughly 1 year each time, I think you're telling me it's going to be 7 or 8 years from now when Parker gets on station and starts taking the real data. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
No, this October, they'll start with the science, but it's still going to be far away, you know, probably, you know, maybe around Mercury's distance or so. It's going to wind up like one-tenth of the distance of Mercury. It's going to be very close to the sun as far as that's concerned. But that's the goal, to get within 3.8 or 3.7 million miles from the sun. That's not going to happen until 7 years from now. And after that, you know, as anybody's guess, they'll probably just leave it like that. But the first year, you know, they'll start taking measurements in October. And that's something to look forward to see the results, make sure everything's working. And that's October. A lot to talk about on the net, because November we'll be talking about the day after Thanksgiving, the landing of the impact mission on the way to Mars. We'll be talking about that one. It's going to land on Mars. And then in January we'll have the Kuiper Belt mission. But yeah, right away the science should be coming back in October.
So October is going to be the first pass, maybe at the distance of Mercury toward the sun with Parker, and you get data. And it's going to be a total of seven passes of Venus. I am guessing you're dissipating energy on each pass of Venus, and therefore you're getting closer and closer to the sun. So I'm guessing the data, the perigee to the sun, or perihelion, is going to get lower and lower on each of the seven passes, and therefore the data gets better and better over the next 7 years. Is that approximately what's going to happen with Parker? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yes, that's right. So each year you'll get a report, probably from the net, you know, how much closer they are to the sun until they reach that goal. But, each year they're going to be getting constant feedback. It'll be going to the Deep Space Network. They already have that figured out. The Deep Space Network has to handle, 16 or 17 missions at a time. So, you were talking about earlier, I wanted to comment, and I forgot because I got lost, about the aerobraking of Mars. If you look at some of those spacecraft, like the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or you look at MAVEN, another NASA mission. The solar wings, they're not very flimsy, and they're pretty staunchy, and they kick back a little bit, you know. They're not straight out, and that's because they use them aerodynamically as they do that aero braking when they get near Mars, you know, after getting launched from Earth. And then the MOM mission, the one that's in orbit around Mars from India, MOM, has the same type of deal. They go through countless aero-braking passes. You know, sometimes it takes like 6 or 8 months to do it, but eventually it slows them down enough to get into a proper circular orbit.
So using aero-braking with Mars is a very efficient way as opposed to using rocket power. In the case of the missions that went into orbit around Jupiter or Saturn, there you don't want to go close to those planets because I think there's an atmosphere that's not quite as friendly, a lot of radiation and so on. So they really used rocket deceleration to go to send a spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter or Saturn. They didn't want to use aero-braking there for a whole bunch of reasons. You've got a nice, mild atmosphere, very little atmosphere around Mars, good for aero-braking. But I don't think they stood a chance of using aero-braking with Jupiter or Saturn. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
You're right. What they did with Cassini, they did take the antenna, the dish antenna. I think they had a 12-foot diameter dish. And they put it in a forward direction as they first went into orbit around Saturn. I believe they did the same thing with Juno around Jupiter. So, I mean, they weren't using it as aero-braking. They fly their engine now. I'd love to get Cassini and Jupiter, the Jupiter Juno mission. They lit their engines, and they would be on for like 60 minutes or so. I mean, you know, I couldn't believe how much fuel these things had. They would actually be de-accelerating for that amount of time. And I think Saturn, I think they were going like 130 miles an hour, and Juno was even going fast, I think 145,000 miles an hour when it went around Jupiter. So, you know, and Juno was a gigantic spacecraft, and the other one was big too. Cassini, I think, was a little bit bigger than a school bus, but Juno was massive. I think that was solar wings on that. I think go combined around 120 feet long.
Wow. Now, in the case of those two spacecraft that we put into orbit around Jupiter and Saturn, you aim this great big 8 or 10 or 12 foot diameter dish forward. I can think of two reasons for doing that, Paul. One, to act as a shield so that micrometeorites, so to speak, are not hitting the electronics. And second of all, I think there was the equivalent of a microphone or some other kind of acoustic detector coupled to the dish, so therefore every micrometeorite that hit it was recorded, and that way you could find out what were the density of particles at that altitude above Jupiter or Saturn. Is that possibly what was going on there, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
I know that, yeah, definitely as a shield. They were trying to protect the spacecraft. But as far as using it as a detector, sounds good, but I don't remember reading anything about that. It could very well be. So, I don't know. We'll have to see. Just one other topic here. I know it's starting to get late. We'll probably try to see how Roy's doing before he does get any later. But one other quick topic is India had a planned launch a couple of months from now to go to the moon with an orbiter. And then they had a lander and a little rover, around this 50-pound rover that was going to come out of the lander. And that has now been canceled until early next year, 2019. So they're going to lose 4 or 5 months. But I follow all the ones, you know, India and China and all that. So it's amazing. We have quite a few on the drawing board as well, and eventually we'll be going back to the moon. we'll follow them as they go. Back to you.
I may have the name wrong, Paul, but I think there was something called the Anselmo X Prize or something like that. In other words, there was a prize being offered for a non-military, commercial, or private organization that launched a spacecraft to the moon, landed on the moon, traversed a certain distance on the moon, took photographs on the moon, and mailed them back home. I think there was a great big prize, and various people were involved in that competition for this lunar landing transmission, translation, and picture-taking. What happened to that competition? Did that get canceled, or did it fall by the wayside, or did it get rescheduled? I vaguely remember the deadline was 2018 for that one. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, there's two different prizes that were offered over the years that I remember. A Saudi prize. I'm trying to think how to say it. It starts with letter A. I'll look it up. Sunny, I think her name was. There's a woman that goes under that name that eventually she wound up in space on the International Space Station for like 9 days or so, and then came back. She was one of the tourists, and she had a prize, or that family had a prize anyway, under that name to put somebody into space on their own rocket and, you know, commercial, and then do it again. Had to be done within 2 weeks, and that was successfully done years ago by Composite. The name of the company is Composite. They sent Spaceship One up there and did that. But then there's the Google Prize. That's what you're thinking about, the Google Prize. Let me drop it. Google Prize was this, a $20 million prize. If you get to the moon and land your spacecraft on the moon, take some HD pictures, send them back to Earth, and then physically have your spacecraft somehow get from its landing location to 500 meters away, and then do the same thing, send some more pictures back, then you're going to get your $10 or $20 million, whatever. I think it was $20 million. And this all had to be done by 2017. You needed a contract, to do this. I think as late as 2016. They pushed it another year. They knew everybody's having problems. So they said you have to at least have a contract by December of 2017 to with some launch company, in the SpaceX or India or China or somebody, the Russians, and nobody made it. So they, last March, they officially canceled it. That's it. There's no more prize. But these companies were still in competition. You have Moon Express, you have the Peregrine Lander that's being built by another company. I think it's Astrobotic. Making the Peregrine Lander. You've got a company in Israel that actually has a contract now with SpaceX. Let me drop it. To land that vehicle on the moon. So they're still going to do it. It's just that, you're not going to win anything. But everybody's goal is to, I guess, eventually supply materials to the moon, or bring back maybe materials from the moon for research. Who knows? But you had at one time 24 different companies, entities around the world that were involved in this. Back to you there.
Wow, and it got canceled. So I guess the task definition was a little bit too elaborate and a little bit too soon. I guess with hindsight, Google should have set a slightly later date so that people had a chance. I think the way it was lined up, though, when you looked at the price of the boosting and the price of developing the hardware and the size of the prize, I think even if you win, you lose money. So that's a bit of a discouragement. didn't Virgin Atlantic win some kind of a prize by building a spacecraft that got into the altitude of space and do it again within a week? Wasn't there a prize for that one that Virgin Atlantic won, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that was the $10 million salary prize. And that was the one that composite materials, they with a fellow named Rutan, designed and built that thing. And late coming to that was Branson. And the main guy involved with that was Paul Allen from one of the original owners of Microsoft, you know, with Gates. He was the main guy. And then, yeah, Branson signed on. He was kind of like involved at the very end as an investor. And then as time went on, he pretty much took over the whole thing. But since then, he's sent that out for different bids for to also get invested with that. Now he's only down to, I think, 30 or 35% ownership, is from what I remember reading. But he has plans on going up on Spaceship 2 when that's ready. And they're doing pretty good lately. Back to you, Dave.
Is Spaceship 2 the process by which people have already put down their deposits so that they can fly to space? And is that part of this? Is Virgin Atlantic involved in that one, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the one. Virgin Galactic is the name that they're using for that. And it's called Spaceship 2. And you need to put down around $200,000. I think it's up to $250,000. And a lot of people have put down, like, you know, 10% of the money or something. There's some 600 people that are, you know, waiting for their tickets. So he's not selling any more tickets until the first 600 go. And he plans on being like the first guy on the first commercial flight, Branson, as well as some of his family members are willing to go up with him. So, yeah, that's coming up. I wouldn't be surprised if it's by the end of this year, maybe beginning of next year. They've probably got to run around four or five more tests. They're halfway there. They get up to around 180,000 feet. They need to get to just over 300,000 feet. You know, they've got to get to that 100-kilometer Kármán line, 62 miles.
So your prediction that might take place at the end of this year is what I think you're saying, or the beginning of 2019, Paul? And so once that really gets rolling, is that going to be a flight every week or so?
I guess eventually, but he's got two more of these things in the factory being produced right now. So, but you know, they keep taking it up for test flights, the pilot and co-pilot, and each time they go up, they go higher and higher. The engine flies for a longer and longer period of time. I guess eventually they'll be able to do it. So if you get into one of these spacecraft, you'll have a pilot, co-pilot, and six paying passengers. And remember, this is not orbital, so you'll have a couple of minutes of weightlessness, and then you'll come back and land on a runway. But not to be outdone, you have Blue Origin, which is going to launch, which is Jeff Bezos. You know, he's the richest guy in the world right now. He's developing Shepard, and Shepard will eventually take passengers up as well, suborbital. You know, you get into your space vehicle in West Texas, and they've got the launch pad there and everything, and you climb in with no pilot, no co-pilot, just six passengers. It's going to be all autonomous, and one big engine for your booster, called the BE-3 engine. The BE-3 engine will fire. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. Take you up to a suborbital flight. You'll separate from the booster. Booster will come down and land vertically, just like SpaceX does with theirs. And then your capsule will float away, and you'll have a few few minutes of weightlessness and eventually come back with some kind of a heat shield. And then the parachutes open up and you're going to land on solid ground. Back to you, Jeff.
I believe the spacecraft is boosted to a high altitude on this composite aircraft with two fuselages side by side. Does it go to something like 50,000 feet before launch? And this is almost a straight up and straight down. Is there any talk about extending the flight to be a little bit longer suborbital so you get a little bit more time in space, or is that out of the question, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I guess if they could increase the volume of the rocket, I guess why not, sure. Maybe in the future, probably not in this one, but maybe their future designs, you know, they have two more being ready. They're called Spaceship Two, by the way, and it's really only one rocket. It's in the middle, and it's just got the two wings that are sticking out. Kind of gives you that kind of look, like there's two fuselages. It's kind of like two wings. And he's got multiple places he wants to take off from. He wants to take off from the spaceport in New Mexico. He wants to take off from another place. He just signed a contract in Italy. And he also wants to take a place, take off in his home country of the UK. I believe that he's setting up a runway over there, too. Back to you, Dick.
I think you're talking about Branson. And so, with these various places to take off, is he going to land back at the same place he takes off from? Or is he landing some hundreds of miles downrange, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, he's going to come back to the same runway. He gets up to 50,000 feet with the White Knight carrier vehicle. And, you know, he's attached to the middle of that, the bottom of the middle of that. And it's got four jet engines on that thing. So that carrier vehicle will get him up to a height, and then he'll get released. And then when he's clear of the carrier vehicle, the engine will ignite, and he's going to go straight up. And so you get to your apogee. The White Knight has a pilot in it, and that's going to fly around and come back and land on the runway. And eventually, you're going to come around, and you're going to land in the same runway as well. Back to you, Dick.
I presume the engine on the White Knight, or something more conventional, jet or turboprop. But the engine that's on the actual spacecraft, that's a kind of solid rocket booster, isn't it, Paul? K2IW?
Yeah, it's kind of rubberized. It's like melt down a bunch of tires and put it in there properly and ignite it. I guess that's the best way to put it. So, yeah, it's kind of like a solid booster rocket. And that's it. The White Knight, the original White Knight, there's White Knight 1 and White Knight 2. The original White Knight that took up the original Spaceship 1 where they won the Ansari Prize for $10 million. That was a propeller, two propellers on it. And it carried the vehicle up to height. Naturally, it was much smaller. It just had room for a pilot. This thing is much bigger, the Spaceship 2. So it's got a bigger carrier vehicle, and they call it White Knight 2, and it has four jet engines attached to it. So there's a more interesting carrier vehicle being built by somebody completely different. The original guy that did that was the main investor for the Spaceship 1, Paul Allen, got his money all poured into Stratolauncher. Stratolauncher is this massive carrier vehicle, and that's got six Rolls-Royce jet engines, 747 engines attached to this thing. And he's should be ready to fly that by the end of the year as well. As a, you know, right now he hasn't gotten off the ground yet.
I just did a quick calculation because I don't have a good feeling for what 100 kilometers is. So we define space as the beginning of space at 100 kilometers, which is a little bit shy of 330,000 feet. And I think these spacecraft are only going to be up there for a very brief period of time. So the total amount of weightlessness and really space view where you see a black horizon and the curvature of the Earth, let me think now. Remember from the altitude of the International Space Station, which is like 220 miles, you only see 3% of the Earth's surface. From 330,000 feet, which is 62 miles, I think you're only going to see 1% of the Earth's surface. You'll see the Earth curvature. You'll see a black space. But I think the total amount of duration of space is going to be kind of brief. I think we discussed once before, are the passengers going to be wearing any kind of a space suit that protects them from depressurization? WS2N, K2IW.
They're going to have something like that. The two pilots, they look like fighter pilots. That's what they're wearing. So they're not completely enclosed. Very strange looking. That's pilot and co-pilot. And they go up on a regular basis now. And they take pictures when they're up there. And you can see the curvature of the Earth, and they're only halfway up. They're going around 30-some-odd miles up. But that's higher than where the balloons go. Your highest balloons go to 20,000 feet. And they say you can see the curvature of the Earth with that, no problem. So they're going up a little over 30 miles now. You got to remember, most of the atmosphere is, on Earth is 12 miles high. It's 12 miles. Once you get above 12 miles, it's very rarefied. You know, you can do anything you want up there and not worry about it. That's why they are able to essentially split this vehicle in half. It bends. It's like a hinge. And the whole back separate, you know, hinges in relationship to the front end by 90 degrees, and then it comes flying back eventually through the atmosphere. Kind of heat shield or anything. It keeps it also pointing down, you know, because of this, the back part is, you know, wide. It's kind of like a birdie when you're playing badminton. You know, the pointed it and it's going to stay forward. And then as they're coming down, you know, they're still way above the 12 mile mark. Eventually they change that configuration, and now it's, you know, completely in line. It looks like a regular airplane type of thing again, and it comes back and lands on a runway.
Now, that 90-degree bend is a kind of aero braking, as I see it, Paul, to allow you to dive back through the atmosphere without picking up a whole lot of velocity. But I think one of the failures they had is where that 90-degree bend occurred during the boost phase, and wasn't that one of the failures that created a death? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, the original Spaceship Two, they called it Enterprise. This one has a new name called Unity. And Enterprise, unfortunately, they think the co-pilot accidentally hit a lever or pushed a button or did something, and then it made this thing start to hinge. And they were within, not only within atmosphere, the rocket motor was gone, so it was destroyed, and the pilot was able to live. And since then, of course, with this new one, they put all kinds of protection systems in where there's no way in the world you could hit this before you're supposed to hit the button or lever or whatever it might be. So they've changed all of that. I wonder if Roy is out there. We only had 6 minutes left. I wonder if his radio's working. We should go over to him for a test or something. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
You're absolutely right, Paul. AC2GS. Let's see how the propagation is now, Paul. I mean, Roy, AC2TS, K2RIW.
Well, I'm still here, and I'm pushing 11 decibels more, and I don't think it quite sounds as bad. I'm just looking at my sound envelope. How do I sound?
He's great. He's great.
Dead full quieting. We should have turned that over to you earlier. So what was the change? More power, or did the propagation get better? Unfortunately, you've only got 5 minutes, but you own it. Well, we go 2 minutes beyond. So you've got 7 minutes total. Use it any way you want, Roy. I'm sorry I didn't go back to you earlier. And what change did you make? AC2GS, K2RIW?
It's no problem. I used my overthruster. Occasionally, when jammers get overactive, I turn this thing on, and it puts out about 120 watts of power. But that's very strange, because I've always used about 8 watts for this repeater and not had any problem. Matter of fact, after I had the problem here, I went over to my local KC2RC repeater, which is in downtown Brooklyn. It's not that close to me. And I got a full quieting report with something like 4 or 5 watts. So, I don't know, I think Eric might have to go up to the repeater and kick it a few times.
You're so dead full quieting right now. Can you go back to the 8 watts right now? I'll bet you're going to be dead full quieting at 8 watts. I think it's some kind of a change at the repeater itself, not you.
Okay, we're back to the old way. How am I? Yeah, it looks fine. The waveform. Again, I don't think it was anything here, because my antenna fell down during the winter and I put it up during the spring, so that's not a problem. And I also tried another radio with another antenna and you couldn't hear me. So I think the repeater hiccuped or something.
Either that or propagation. Tiny bit of noise, but you sound beautiful right now. You own the next 5 minutes, Roy.
Okay, if you want one of the quickie ones, let's see what I got here. Aging infrastructure currently orbiting Mars to threaten the viability of the future missions to Red Planet. That is according to a new report by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, which warned that the loss of even a single Mars orbiter, essential for communicating with Martian rovers, could make it difficult to support planned sample return missions to the Red Planet. The report, Visions into Voyages for Planetary Science in the Decade 2013 to 2022, a midterm review, provided a series of recommendations to ensure NASA fulfills the goals of the present 10-year survey for planetary science, which began in 2013. Many of the recommendations revolve around Mars, including the continued planning and implementation of a Mars sample return mission. The report also calls on NASA to completely reassess its Mars program, from developing a strategic plan and budget to implementing a new management structure, establishing partnerships, including with commercial firms. Let me drop.
Roy, is there any chance that that rig is heating up and decreasing in power output? You're getting weaker and weaker and noisier as you proceed. Go ahead.
Well, I guess anything is possible, but I'm looking at the power output of my amplifier, and it seems to be solid. So, again, I'm not quite sure if it's me or the repeater acting up.
I'll go back to using the afterburner, Paul. I mean, we heard everything up till now, but it's getting noisier. Please use the afterburner.
Hey, how's this?
Quite a little bit noisier than before. So it is the repeater or the propagation. Go right ahead. You're now only 5% noise, but go right ahead, Roy.
Hey, NASA builds extremely capable spacecraft that frequently last far longer than their design times, which results in a rich and ongoing science return above and beyond what was originally planned, reported co-chair Louise Proctor from the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. However, relying on this aging infrastructure is a potential risk. We are recommending that NASA evaluate how much of a risk this is. The report, written by a 12-strong panel, concludes that NASA's Planetary Science Division has made impressive progress in meeting and even exceeding some of the goals set out in the 2013 Decadal Survey. It has done so despite significant cuts in its budget early in the current decade. NASA is doing a good job in following research priorities laid out in 2013 survey, given the very challenging budget situation that they faced with it at the beginning of the decade, said Proctor. Let me drop.
We just passed the bewitching hour, Roy, so we're about to be cut off in a minute or so. That was TechNet number 1711. That was Space Report number 181. And you're listening to the tail end of Science Talk number 41. Thank you, you all. And back to you, Roy. And sorry that the propagation was giving you this much trouble tonight. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Better next time, what can I say? I don't know if it's propagation or it's the repeater acting up or what the heck's going on. So hopefully everyone will figure it out long before it comes to next Sunday, right? So once again, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and you can go to roy.ac2gs for a link to the few articles that I mentioned and Paul's article as well.
Well done. Bye-bye, Paul. WS2N for any final, K2RAW. See you next week, Paul.
73, and have a good night. And I'm glad to hear Roy. At least we heard him for a while there. That's good. We're going in the right direction. Next week, I'm sure it'll be straightened out. We'll be back to normal. 73, WS2N clear.
With the rain we've been having, I'm guessing it's propagation. Bye-bye, you guys. K2RIW clear.
Repeaters full quieting the Franklin Square on an HD in the basement, N2RDB.
Thank you, sir.